In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Plenty coming your way this hour. We'll get an update from the State House. Aaron Murphy with that. Also, a Des Moines woman pleading guilty this week to two hate crime charges. And I'll talk with a representative of the Des Moines Police about his department's reaction to this week's big news, of course, nationally, centered around that Minneapolis Derek Chauvin verdict. But let's start off the hour with several developments in the news concerning the vaccination campaign. Natalie Krebs, our health reporter at IPR, is with us. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, Ben.
Well, let's talk first of all about what the governor had to say this week, because we are seeing a dip in demand for vaccines. The governor imploring Iowans, those who haven't, to get vaccinated, right?
Right, yeah. So Governor Reynolds today at her press conference really just used that time to push Iowans to get the vaccine. She revealed at that press conference 43 counties this week either declined part or all of their vaccine allocation. That was so that their supply didn't, you know, outstrip demand. So we've kind of seen a shift here. You know, only just a couple weeks ago, we saw, you know, demand way outstrip supply. And, you know, Reynolds is just really pleading with Iowans, really asking them to get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. And so what do we know? And I know the governor made some comments about finding out more about what's behind some people's hesitancy. I think there are a variety of reasons. What do we know about the reasons people are not choosing to get vaccines at this time? Hopefully they will in the future.
Right. At her press conference, Governor Reynolds put a lot of emphasis on age. So looking at some of the recent polling numbers, she talked about how younger adults seem to be a little bit more hesitant about the vaccine. They're a little bit more in the won't get it or the wait and see category, which is why she said she's been so adamant about getting university students vaccinated before they go home for the summer holiday, trying to target that hesitant population. Other populations we've seen more hesitant, Republicans, evangelical Christians have been a group that's ranked really high with vaccine hesitancy. Governor Reynolds was asked about this group at the press conference. She didn't really address it directly. She just basically said the state continues to look at groups that are more hesitant about the vaccine and they're working on encouraging people to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and her comment, I think, quoting from that news conference, what are you waiting for, right?
Exactly.
To all those, and indeed that is the question, because as we've talked about so many times here, Natalie, getting a shot in the arm with a COVID-19 vaccine is not only something you can do to help your health, but the health of our communities and our nation. It's for the good of all, right? And I saw in your reporting, too, that the leader of the Iowa National Guard is encouraging all eligible Iowans to get vaccinated.
Yeah, this was at the press conference as well. And again, another way that Governor Reynolds was trying to encourage people to get vaccinated, she brought the leader of the Iowa National Guard, Ben Correll, up. And he talked about how he had contracted COVID-19 in November and was actually hospitalized for a week. He got that sick and said, you know, in his whole life, he's never been hospitalized before, only when he was born, and still has some lingering side effects like shortness of breath all these months later. He really encouraged members of the Iowa National Guard. He said half of them haven't been vaccinated yet to get the vaccine, and really, you know, pushed for people to get it, saying, you know, this is serious. You know, I, as the leader of the Iowa National Guard, I'm a very healthy adult. I have to keep very physically fit, and this made me very sick. So getting a vaccination is a very good protection against this virus.
Mm-hmm. Natalie, let's quickly talk about where we are with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that has been in the news. This is the vaccine among the three approved, Moderna, Pfizer, and the Johnson & Johnson. This is the only one of the three approved vaccines that requires just one dose. So it really offers some advantages, but we had some setbacks. So remind us of those.
Right. Yeah. So last week, you know, federal and state officials recommended a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine related to six severe blood clots found in six women who had received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The FDA met last week. They said they basically needed more time to assess this and what to do with these blood clots. And so, you know, everyone's pretty much followed that pause. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is still on pause. Again, a recommended pause, not a required pause. We're waiting to see still to see what the FDA says. Dr. Anthony Fauci said earlier this week that it could be, you know, Friday that we see the FDA kind of make recommendations and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you know, start to be used again. I'm keeping an eye on that to see when we hear news about what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And as you reported, this is really an important vaccine for some vulnerable groups who would find it difficult or it's difficult to schedule two appointments for shots, the homeless, right?
Right. And what's special about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is that it is the only one-dose vaccine. The Moderna and Pfizer, you know, require that second dose booster to be as effective as they are. And so in all this with the pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is it sort of caused some groups that have set up clinics for vulnerable populations like people who are homeless, that includes immigrant and refugee communities, to kind of decide if they want to switch to the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine, which is hard because these are groups that, you know, might not necessarily make a follow-up appointment. It's harder for them to get to a follow-up appointment. Or, you know, just wait to vaccinate this vulnerable group. And so, you know, it's been hard for some of these groups.
Mm-hmm. On the way out, before we say goodbye on this Friday, Natalie, a quick look at the data, of course, along with the number of vaccinations we have in the state and the nation. Want to keep our eye on the Midwest, the Iowa data in terms of infections and hospitalizations, right? How is that looking?
Yeah, so we're looking at over 50% of eligible adults. So that's about 2.4 million people in Iowa have received at least one dose of a vaccine. 38% have completed a vaccination series. So they're fully vaccinated. That includes the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, those who got that one. The thing is, we're still seeing, you know, hundreds of new cases reported every day. And more alarmingly, our hospitalizations are still above 200. Yesterday, that was Thursday, there were 235. Which is as high as they've been in a while. Today they're down to 217, but you know, like for the past couple weeks, like over 2 weeks, now we're coming down 3 weeks, you know, Iowa just hasn't really been able to drop below that 200 number, which again, with the new variants known to be widely spread in Iowa, we just know that the virus is still out there, it's still spreading, it's still very much a pandemic.
Okay. Natalie Krebs, IPR's health reporter. Thank you for an update on this Friday. Have a wonderful weekend, Natalie.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, the news this week, the big news for the whole country came out of Minneapolis, that guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin murder case. Later in the program, reaction from the Des Moines Police Department. I'll talk with Sergeant Paul Parizic. But first, you may remember this case in our news from about 5 years ago. It was the case of a Cedar Rapids police officer who in 2016 shot and paralyzed a black motorist. Well, this week, an $8 million settlement was reached. In fact, the day before the lawsuit was to go to trial, an insurance carrier for the city of Cedar Rapids has agreed to pay motorist Jeremy Mitchell and his wife $8 million. This is subject to approval by this Cedar Rapids City Council, which is set to meet next week. Laura Schultes is an attorney with RSH Legal based in Cedar Rapids. She joins me now. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, you and your firm were involved in this case. Tell us, before we talk about it quickly, how were you involved?
Sure. My firm, RSH Legal, was local counsel on this case. So the lead attorney was Larry Rogers, who's with the Power Rogers firm based in Chicago. And my firm was retained to be the local counsel on that. And I worked on the case along with one of the partners in our firm, Presley Henningsen.
Laura, I just watched that dash cam video of the incident from November of 2016. Remind us what happened. Also a hard video to watch. Remind us what took place that night. It was actually an early morning, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the early morning hours of November 1st, 2016. Former officer Lucas Jones was on patrol in the Co-College Mound View neighborhood of Cedar Rapids and had his K-9 unit with him. And he made a traffic stop of our client, Jeremy Mitchell, about 1 o'clock in the morning that day. And the stated reason for the traffic stop was that our client allegedly had a license plate light that was out. So the license plate wasn't illuminated. So this was a routine traffic stop. As you can see in the video, if you watch it on YouTube, as the stop happened, it escalated. Our client, Jeremy, explained that, he didn't think his license plate light was out. The plan was for him to get out of the vehicle and go back to look at the back of the vehicle to see if there in fact was a traffic violation or not. And after he stepped out of the vehicle, is the video sort of speaks for itself. You can see that a struggle ensued. Lucas Jones, the officer that night, eventually released his K-9 unit. They continued to struggle. Jeremy was scared. He was fearful. And he was fearful of the officer and of the dog. And as he was scrambling to get back in his vehicle to a safe place, Lucas Jones reached for his gun and fired a few shots into the vehicle. And one of them hit Jeremy in his neck and has left him a quadriplegic. Mm-hmm.
The insurance carrier for Cedar Rapids, the city, agreed to this plea of this settlement, I should say, without acknowledging fault or liability on the part of the defendants. Tell us, the $8 million settlement for Jeremy and his wife, other important conditions of the settlement you can mention?
No, I think a lot of that money is going to be set aside for Jeremy's medical needs. There's been a lot of medical needs to date, and some of those medical bills still need to be taken care of and worked through the system. And then there's a lot of needs that he has going forward. As you've seen in the news, a lot of times in these shooting incidents, the individual doesn't survive. Jeremy survived. He lived to tell his story, and his life has been forever changed. He's, his wife Bracken is a nearly full-time caretaker for him. And so a lot of this settlement, is going to allow him to pursue some therapies and some equipment and treatment that he really needs. Yeah. It's a city settlement. So of course it's, public in terms of the amount and the terms of the settlement. But, I think you've hit the highlights there in terms of what it means and the dollar amount.
Mm-hmm. Your client, Jeremy Mitchell, is Black. The officer, since fired, is white, former officer. How do you see this case this week and now in the context of the verdict this week and the nationwide clamor for more equitable treatment of African Americans in our country by police? Does this fit into that picture?
I absolutely think that it does. Our incident happened in 2016, November of 2016. Of course, the massive movements that we saw sparked last summer after George Floyd's death came much later. It took a long time for our case to get to the point of trial because we had some issues that we had to take up with the Supreme Court, and then the pandemic hit. But I think this case is a stark reminder, Jeremy's case is a stark reminder that these are issues that communities of all sizes have to reckon with. This isn't stuff that just happens in the nation's biggest cities or out on the coasts. It's happening right here. Jeremy's case is not the only case involving a city settlement for police excessive use of force in Iowa. And, you know, we saw in Cedar Rapids last summer protests like we saw across the country and across the world. And Jeremy spoke at some of those demonstrations. So I absolutely think that it fits into that narrative. I think it hopefully will spark further conversations here locally about what needs to happen with our police systems and in our communities. And, you know, one of the things that I think Jeremy and his wife Bracken feel, you know, proud of is the fact that our case, this civil litigation, was the reason that led to, you know, Lucas Jones being further investigated and ultimately terminated last summer as a result of, you know, some of his conduct in an incident one shift prior to when he shot Jeremy, and then in statements that he made that were later found to be untruthful during the investigation of this shooting of Jeremy Mitchell. So I think there's been some concrete changes already locally, and I think it fits into that broader narrative of conversations that communities of all sizes need to be having.
Laura Schultz is an attorney with RSH Legal based in Cedar Rapids. Laura, thank you for your view on this.
Thank you for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Before the break, let's get a quick update of State House developments this week. Aaron Murphy joins us, Des Moines Bureau Chief at Lee Enterprises. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Ben.
Thanks for coming back on the program. What, as we end this week at the legislature, we're closing in on the end of this session. What do you have your eyes on, especially at the State House this week?
Yeah, we're at that point of the session where the gears are really starting to grind and things are moving a little slowly, and it's kind of the big budget negotiations that are taking place to get the next year's state budget done and finish up their work for the session. So there wasn't a ton of action as far as floor debate and that kind of stuff. It's getting those big dollar amounts settled, and there's some big tax policy issues that they're working out. And it's kind of interesting, even with unified government, Republicans have majorities and control the agenda in both chambers, and they have the Republican governor, but there's still enough disagreement on some of those pieces that there's details to be worked out and deals to be made still.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can tell us anything more about the budget specifically for the Department of Corrections, of course, due to those killings at the Anamosa Penitentiary.
Yeah, that's a number that there's still all three legs of that stool that I just mentioned, the two chambers and the governor's office, they've all endorsed the idea of adding some funding for the state prison system. What exactly that number is that they land on is still being worked out, but they are at least in agreement that they want to get more funding to those prisons, to the system in general, and then, you know, let those folks decide whether that means, you know, boosting the salaries of folks who are already there because they haven't received much in the way of raises in recent years, or maybe enable them to hire more folks. So it's just that what that final number is that they still have to decide on. And I suppose I should point out of fairness that the Democrats, who are in the minority in both chambers, are saying that the numbers need to be higher than what Republicans have been talking about and proposing. They feel that there's more of a need for staffing out there that needs even more funding than what's being pitched.
Mm-hmm. Just a few minutes ago, I spoke with Natalie Krebs, our health reporter, about the governor imploring Iowans to get vaccinated. As you and she reported, about half of Iowa's counties, we've really had a flip. Half of Iowa's counties about rejected some or all new vaccine shipments from the state because they have not yet used previous allotments, according to state public health officials. That's up from 20 counties just a week ago. I want your thoughts, Aaron. What can the governor do about hesitant Iowans, really, considering the polls showing that really some key constituencies of Republicans, namely Republicans, men, and evangelicals, are the groups most resisting getting the vaccine?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we actually put that to the governor this week. And I'll give credit to David Pitt, the great reporter for the Associated Press, and the way he phrased it. He asked the governor, is that just a tough nut to crack? Essentially, you know, to your point, is that just too big an uphill climb? The governor has tried to tackle that by leading by example from her own standpoint. She received the vaccine and did so in public, you know, live during one of her press conferences. And she has talked about the need to get vaccinated during all her press conferences. So she's trying to lead by example, and she's also talked about trying to work with people on the local level to also relay that message, and her suggestion being that for those folks who may be harder to convince, they're more likely to have their mind changed by someone that they know really well. So what Governor Reynolds is saying is, it doesn't do maybe as good for me to stand up here and say it to that person as it does someone who that person knows in their community. So trying to build those community relationships and get that message out on the local level as well.
In the minute or so we have, you did some reporting, in fact, talking with the Iowa Secretary of State, Paul Pate. Of course, the national context here, the heated debate over election law changes pushed by Republicans in states across the U.S., including here in Iowa, Democrats across the nation charging voter suppression in many of these laws. You had a chance to talk to our Secretary of State about Iowa's new laws. What did you most want to know?
Well, I wanted to know basically how he felt about it, because he didn't really weigh in on that big bill during its debate, and it wasn't his proposal. Sometimes he does make proposed legislative sessions changes. Pardon me. This didn't come from him. This came from state legislators. So I was curious to hear his overall opinion of it. And basically what he said is he does not have concerns that it will suppress turnout. In fact, the point he tried to make was that it's the candidates, the interest in the candidates, that really drive up turnout more than regulations around voting. So it'll be interesting to see in future elections what kind of impact these changes have. But it was our state Secretary of State's opinion that the new laws will not suppress turnout or make it harder to vote.
Right, and we've had election law changes in the past, passed by Republicans, and we had a record turnout. So as you said, Aaron,
exactly
We need to watch, and thank you for this. We're coming up on our break, so we'll say goodbye tonight. And are you part of tonight's Iowa Press on PBS at 7:30?
That's right. We've stayed out of the Rob Sand, covered a lot of interesting topics, so worth folks' time to check it out.
Thank you. Aaron Murphy is the Des Moines Bureau Chief at Lee Enterprises. Aaron, always good to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Great to be on.
Coming up after a short break, we'll talk about the case of a Des Moines woman pleading guilty to two hate crime charges this week. Philip Jones of the Des Moines Register on that. Also, I talk with Sergeant Paul Parizic of the Des Moines Police Department. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. IPR News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Here First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters. Learn about what's going on at the State House and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Here First today, wherever you get your podcasts.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
So glad you're on board on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this April 23rd. Well, this week, a woman charged with intentionally hitting two children with her vehicle in December of 2019, because of their skin color, pleaded guilty this week in federal court to two hate crime charges. Joining us, Philip Jones. He's covered this story. He's the breaking news and public safety reporter at the Des Moines Register. Philip, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what happened. Remind us, because this was something we, a lot of us, remember in our news from December of 2019. Tell us about the incident.
Well, Ben, so on December 9th, 2019, Nicole Poole Franklin, who's a 43-year-old resident of Des Moines, intentionally hit a 12-year-old boy who is black and a 14-year-old Latina girl. She then was charged with yelling racial epithets at a gas station employee about an hour after that. It was a really big story at the time that really shocked the community and hurt a lot of people here, if you can remember that far back.
Philip, before we get on to proceedings that happened this week, tell us, how is the boy, how is the girl who were hit back in 2019? Were they injured?
So they were both injured. The boy suffered minor injuries to his leg. The girl was hospitalized for 2 days, according to the Associated Press. She was in court this week as well and appeared to be doing at least okay physically.
Yeah, and it was sort of a tear. These things happened. We're separated by several minutes, the hitting the 12-year-old black child, hitting the 14-year-old Latina girl, and then going to this gas station and yelling these racial and ethnic slurs. So tell us what happened this week.
So this week, on Monday, she entered a guilty plea. Those documents actually became public on Tuesday in state court. She pleaded guilty in state court to two counts of attempted murder. Each one of those counts carries a sentence of up to 25 years in prison. She could serve the sentences at the same time, or they could run consecutively. If you think of batters in baseball, you know, hitting consecutive home runs, you know, she would have to serve them one after the other. But surprisingly, on Wednesday, she pleaded guilty pretty much out of nowhere to federal hate crime charges. Now, it turns out what we've learned in the past couple of days is that there was a real, over the past month or two, her attorneys learned that she would be indicted in federal court as well. So both state and federal prosecutors essentially agreed to a what they call a global plea agreement. Prosecutors in federal court are going to recommend that she is sentenced to 324 months, which is 27 years in prison. Essentially, it's a wash, her attorney in state court said.
Mm-hmm. The real puzzling part of this is her mental state, her motive here. Tell us what's been discovered about that. What caused her to run over a child, two children?
Police said that she admitted to smoking meth hours before the incident. In federal court this week, she admitted, or she said that she was schizophrenic, and that she suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder, though she did not say what she suffers PTSD from. She also said that, you know, it's been hard for her to get therapy in her adult life. Mm-hmm. But people that I talked to this week said that that really is an excuse for what she did. You know, I spoke with a person who said she knew that she had to drive on the right side of the road and that they weren't buying mental health as an excuse, this person said, for doing this.
Right. And she described what she said. She thought, for instance, the boy was an Islamic terrorist.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. In federal court on Wednesday, she said that she thought the black child was actually of Middle Eastern descent and was in the Islamic State terrorist group. Clive police also said after the incident had happened that when she hit the Latina girl that she hit her because she was, quote, Mexican, unquote.
Hmm. Okay. Philip, how rare are hate crimes in Iowa?
Frankly, it's really hard to say. You know, the FBI stats from 2019 show that only six hate crimes occurred in Iowa, none of which occurred in Des Moines. And obviously we're talking about a hate crime that occurred at least partially in Des Moines. You know, there was a notable incident last year where a man named Darquan Jones was assaulted because of his race and had his arm broken actually just days before George Floyd's death up in Minneapolis. That really sparked a lot of outrage from the community. One of the suspects in that case has pleaded guilty. The other is proceeding to trial as of now. So it's really hard to say how they're certainly rare, but it's hard to say how rare.
Right. And as you bring out in your reporting, it's thought to be severely underreported.
Right.
Things that just don't get make it to law enforcement, right?
Right.
Okay, Philip Jones, a breaking news and public safety reporter with the Des Moines Register. Thank you so much for filling us in on the latest developments in this disturbing case dating back to 2019.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's been a few days since a jury in Minneapolis convicted former police officer Derek Chauvin on two counts of murder, one count of manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. The day following the verdicts, we heard reaction from Black Iowa organizers on this program. Well, we wanted to know what's been the reaction of law enforcement in this state and around the U.S. Joining us now, Sergeant Paul Parizek is the Public Information Officer with the Des Moines Police Department. Sergeant Parizek, thank you for joining our program again.
Well, thank you for having us.
NPR reporting many officers, police officers, and law enforcement organizations in our country expressing relief at the trial's outcome. Give us a sense of the reaction. Your reaction, the Des Moines Police Department's reaction among your colleagues?
Well, I think we share the same sentiments that you're hearing from other places in the nation. There wasn't one of us that saw that video, didn't recognize how wrong that was. Derek Chauvin faced justice, and justice was served, and we're certainly thankful for that.
Mm-hmm. What have been the discussions during the trial that you and your fellow officers have had over the course of this trial? Hearing the testimony, of course, that 9 minutes and 29 second video that we've most all of us have seen that are just so difficult to watch. What kind of discussions has this sparked in your department?
Well, a lot of the discussions at the Des Moines Police Department immediately following that were us to revisit our current training practices and our current policies, because all of that prohibited what we saw in that video. So we wanted to go back and make sure that our officers had a clear understanding of what not just our expectations were, but what the community's expectations were for their behavior. We didn't have anybody that acted surprised about that. We know that we put an emphasis for decades now on making sure that our training is front-loaded with the tools that we need to avoid getting ourselves into that position where we have to use force. There's times when we're not going to be able to avoid it. But As we kept moving forward over the past year, we learned a lot through a lot of the riots and the protests about making some more adjustments to our policy, making sure that we are conscientious of not just what we're doing, but how what we're doing impacts other people. So I think it's been a learning experience for all of us. The one thing that was positive for us is that we're proud of the fact that our policies seemed to be a little bit ahead of a lot of other agencies, and that our practices were also. It's just continuing to, refine those and improve those and get the community's feedback on what their expectations are for our performance.
Mm-hmm. A lot to unpack in what you just said there. Let's go to a couple points. Also, we had state lawmakers imposing some new policing laws here. We had last year amid the protests, lawmakers in a bipartisan way passing a bill to ban chokeholds, revoke certifications for officers fired due to misconduct, giving the Iowa Attorney General power to investigate officer wrongdoing, also requiring implicit bias and de-escalation training. Do you feel you've arrived with enough reforms, or is this sort of in the middle? Where do you see yourself in this process of getting to a better place in policing so that the community feels better and we as a nation feel better about the changes made to policing in the country.
There's always room for improvement. That's the most important thing that we keep our focus on, that there's always ways to make things better. When it came to the police reform legislation that was passed last summer, that was a good opportunity for the Des Moines Police Department to reassure our community that what that was called, the eight can't wait. There were 8 points there that our communities were demanding be part of law enforcement and part of policing. We were able to reassure our community that all 8 of those points have been part of our policy and practice for years. So I think that was an opportunity for us to, as we have in those conversations, to educate some folks about some things about our organization that maybe they didn't know. But also that communication, establishing that a communication opens the door so that we can get their input on things moving forward. We're just going to keep improving with our de-escalation training. There's a piece of it that we're adding that's actually called empathy training. It's always looking for ways to get better at how we interact with the neighborhoods that we serve. And a big part of that is the communication. Now, there's been a little bit of a disconnect. Over the past year, we've seen some real polarized opinions and polarized suggestions on how the policing should be, anywhere from, you know, I back the blue to let's defund the police to let's abolish the police. So we're looking at how we can have those conversations with everyone, and we can find a spot where we all meet and move forward together.
This week, the Minneapolis police chief who testified in that trial was really a key witness. Said he hoped after this verdict that their community can heal there in Minnesota. This trial, of course, and its verdict sending ripples across the country. Even though this murder by a police officer did not happen in Des Moines, do you feel you have work there at the Des Moines Police Department to work harder regarding community relations, especially with minority residents? Is there a, and again, this did not happen in Iowa, but a trust that needs to be worked on, strengthened, rebuilt even?
Absolutely. You know, it didn't happen here, but man, it impacted us significantly here. One thing that I think we learned is that, you know, compassion gives you the ears to listen. And courage gives you the voice to be heard. We saw a lot of righteous anger. Maybe some of those folks we hadn't heard from in the past, but this situation, this incident up there, gave them, empowered them to feel like they had an opportunity to speak out. So there are going to be voices heard now that we weren't hearing before, and that's a good thing. We hope that as we return the conversation, that there are folks that are going to be open to hearing what we have. We understand we're not going to make everybody happy all the time, and some people they're just not going to want to listen to us. But, you know, we're hoping that now that there have been folks who have expressed their frustration and their anger with some things, we can start addressing those issues also. Mm-hmm. But overall, when you look at how the Des Moines Police Department operates, overwhelmingly supported in our community, trusted, but there are times where people don't understand what we're doing or how we're doing those things. We're going to work harder at making sure they do. And we're also going to work harder at making sure we're doing them the right way. You know, mistakes happen. We're human. But there's a lot of them that can be avoided, because if it's predictable, it's preventable.
Okay, let me have you comment quickly. We're running out of time, but quickly on one point that may pertain to exactly what you said. Your police department has faced pushback in recent days over putting a sergeant who has been disciplined for excessive force on a 5-person team that leads de-escalation training. What has been your department's reaction to the sincere concerns, I think you'll grant that, of residents about this choice?
Well, they've been the sincere concerns of a very small portion of our community. Sergeant Fong has got a long career here, and we are not going to just use small fractions of his career to make our decisions. People make mistakes, people learn from them, and people grow. We have folks in our community who are in the same spot, and if we simply dismiss them because of something they did in the past, we might be missing out on a lot of good information, a good relationship to have, and a lot of good leadership. And that's the case with Sergeant Fong. He's done what he needed to do. to improve his career. He's had a promotion since then. He's a vital part of our organization, and we wouldn't have put him in that trusted position if we didn't think it was a good decision and good for our community.
It's been nearly a year since the death of George Floyd and since the protests, these huge protests, which haven't been seen in this country for decades. The policing at the center of it, racial justice at the center of it. I wonder, after all of this, how is morale at the Des Moines Police Department? How has it been through this with you under and your fellow colleagues under such a microscope, along with the rest of law enforcement in this nation?
We're doing well. I mean, and I think you kind of hit on one of the points when you started talking about justice, is that we're here because we want justice for all. And that is something that we keep focused on. We keep focus on our mission. We're looking ahead. We understand our history, but we got to keep our focus on the future. And by doing that, our officers are in a good position to keep themselves happy and healthy and serve the community well. So we're doing well. We're focusing on what our mission is. That's why they got in this business, is to help people. That's what keeps us moving.
Mm-hmm. Has this negatively affected recruiting?
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely an impact on recruiting. The number of applications that we received in this most recent recruitment cycle was about half of what we received in the prior. And that's across the nation. I was just talking to an officer at an agency on the East Coast, and they're down 50 officers. Now, we're certainly not in that spot, but the public sentiment definitely has pushed some people to the point where I actually heard a potential recruit say, "I'd love to be a police officer. I can't deal with the hate." So those are, as we improve these relationships, that'll get better too. Recruitment will get better.
Okay, thank you for your time. Sergeant Paul Parizic, Public Information Officer with the Des Moines Police Department. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thank you for your time, guys.
It's been a heavy news week. I'm so glad I'm joined by my colleague, C.C. Mitchell of Iowa IPR Studio One Tracks. CC, to groove us into the weekend, we need it. What do you have for us? Good afternoon.
Hey, Ben. Yep, I've got a total 180 from that last conversation.
Okay, we need it. Yeah.
Yes. A couple of new tracks, brand new tracks, two new albums released just today. So the first one is by Dinosaur Jr. You might recognize that name. They're very classic in the indie rock world. They've actually been around since 84, and today's new record is their 12th studio album. It's called Sweep It Into Space. I thought that was a cute one. Critics are calling this one their best since their reunion. This reunion stint has actually lasted longer than their initial run from 84 to 89. They've been back since 2005. So I think it's a pretty good sign, and the new album's worth checking out. This track is called Take It Back by Dinosaur Jr.
Love it, Cece. What else do you have for us?
Our next one is by Field Music. That band's a little less iconic than Dinosaur Jr., but they've also been putting out really good indie rock since the mid-2000s. Their new album out today is called Flat White Moon, and I was listening to all of the singles to try to figure out which one I was going to show you today, and they are all over the place. There's a psychedelic one. There's one that kind of sounds like the Beatles. They are from England. But this track, Do Me a Favor, I think that's the best one to transition into the weekend. The new album has something in it for everybody, though. It's what I'm going to be listening to over the weekend. Here's Do Me a Favor by Field Music.
Do me a favor, Field Music, the band. And do yourself a favor, tune in to Cece Mitchell, Mark Simmet, Tony Daner, our Studio One tracks at IPR, your daily soundtrack 7 nights a week, and also Saturdays at 2, Sundays at 8 p.m. Cece, always good to groove into the weekend with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben. Have a good one.
You too. River to River, produced today by Rick Brewer, our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks so much.